Code monkey, get up, get coffee. Code monkey, go to job. Code monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say code monkey, very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of From Python Import Podcast. My name is Chris Miller. I am here with David Stanek.
Hello.
And Michael Crute.
Hi.
And we would like to thank everyone who listened to the first episode. We did get a sizable number of downloads and a large number of comments via Twitter, via IM, via email, via comments on the blog. So we do want to thank everyone. If you like the podcast, please do spread the word. We're doing this for the sheer fun of it.
And it's also probably worth mentioning that we're looking for topic ideas, too.
Right. We are looking for topic ideas. And while we did have Mr. Aaron Oliver have us, he does want us to discuss why you should be building your enterprise apps in Java and not Python. I think we'll bring him on to discuss that.
That sounds like a great segment right there.
I think it would be. It's nothing quite like Aaron picking on you with a pointed stick. So, little announcements. We now are in iTunes. So if you're listening to this, I don't know how you're listening to this if you're an iTunes user and you download it. But regardless, we're in iTunes, so you can go and get us there. That'll just be MP3 only. The AUG feed is only available from the website. We also have a logo. We have album art, thanks to Michael Piernot, who slapped it together and kept running it past us. And we kept going, can you make the green a little more green? Can you put a border? What does it look like without the border? So he was really patient with us, and we're very happy that we now have that going on.
Yeah, and it looks very, very great. I mean, he did an awesome job and spent a lot of time on it.
Yeah, he's probably spent far more time than we paid him for.
A couple weekends, I think so.
You know. So if you see Mike, just you know, slap him across the face because he likes that. So what we are going to bring you both this episode and next episode is we thought that it would be fun to take apart the Zen of Python. And so we will be doing this episode, and then the mid-month special next episode, next month, we'll be covering the Zen of Python. Now, who wants to define the Zen of Python for the nice listeners? Mike.
All right. Well, the Zen of Python is really kind of some guiding principles by which every Python programmer should follow.
Now, really? Or is it
Okay, so half of it's pretty cheeky, but I'm going to go ahead and say there's a lot of good stuff in there that really speaks to some good design principles and is at least worth reading.
And most of it's solid advice and not just for Python. And a lot of it's just common sense.
Oh, most definitely. I think there's some good tie-ins to some of the stuff that Uncle Bob's written in a lot of his books.
You know, when I first saw this, the Zen of Python, the first thing I thought was that it reminded me a lot of the Tao of Programming. You guys have read this, have you not? And, you know, the Tao of Programming is extremely tongue-in-cheek and yet kind of profound and interesting at the same time. And the Zen of Python was written by Tim Peters, and it looks like it was adopted as a PEP. I believe it was PEP 20.
I believe that's correct.
In 2004. And the easiest way to get a hold of this is just to go to your Python interpreter and type import this, and it will print out the following. Beautiful is better than ugly. Explicit is better than implicit. Simple is better than complex. Complex is better than complicated. Flat is better than nested. Sparse is better than dense. Readability counts. Special cases aren't special enough to break the rules, although practicality beats purity. Errors should never pass silently unless explicitly silenced. In the face of ambiguity, refuse the temptation to guess. There should be one, and preferably only one, obvious way to do it. Although that way may not be obvious at first unless you're Dutch. Now is better than never, although never is often better than right now. If the implementation is hard to explain, it's a bad idea. If the implementation is easy to explain, it may be a good idea. Namespaces are one honking great idea. Let's do more of those.
That was the most poetic I think I've ever heard that read.
You should hear my Hamlet.
I'm not sure I want to.
Right. So I wanted to take it apart line by line and have our panel of experts here. Kind of, we just toss this one around. We'll go through the first nine tenets of the Zen of Python. during this episode, and we will pick up the next 10 in the next episode. So.
Well, before we jump in, though, I think it's worth mentioning to everybody, if you haven't read this module, you should definitely take a look at it.
Yes.
The implementation kind of cracks me up.
And that's a good point. I have not read this module. I just know that import this will print this out. So.
I'm sure it's a big nerd joke.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. All right. So, let us begin. Beautiful is better than ugly.
Well, that one kind of speaks for itself on the surface, though.
Well, yes. I mean, it's kind of funny. The beautiful and the ugly could even go beyond code. It goes into design. It goes into execution. It goes into the way you comment. It goes into... I mean, it's just, you know, nice code is better to deal with.
It's also simplicity and testability and all the good stuff that you like to see in code.
Well, and I've kind of been saying for a while, I shamefacedly stole it from somebody, but code is poetry. And and kind of that whole, like, when you read a beautiful poem, you just know by reading it that this is beautiful. This is a work of art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think beautiful code really kind of is like that. You really know beautiful code when you read it.
Well, that's kind of subjective too, though, because you're... The poetry you like might not be the poetry that I like. The classics,
but that's what makes it interesting.
That is true, but I think the comparison to poetry is apt. You know, and while you know you may like Poe and you may like Shakespeare and you may not like each other's poetry, when something hits an aesthetic that you can agree with, and you know rings true to you, then I think there's a certain elegance to it. I know, you know, I think that. I think the beautiful, actually, you could substitute the word elegant in there as well.
Very much.
And I remember reading the book Beautiful Code, and there are some fine examples of what I would consider elegant code in there.
See, I'm not as optimistic about the process here.
Well, see,
because you have somebody that thinks this is beautiful, and someone thinks that's beautiful, and they go rewrite the other beautiful stuff as their beautiful stuff.
Well, I think that's probably
everywhere.
The case, but there's some things that you can agree on that are just uniformly, universally beautiful.
I'm just playing the devil's advocate because I think it's funny.
Thanks, Dick. No, but I think you bring up a fair point, though.
It is
a fair point. All of us have our way of doing things, and we're pretty sure, if you're 100% sure that you're right, you're definitely wrong.
Well, there's only one way to write beautiful.
Then I'm like 99.999% right.
See. I think a certain amount of humility comes with being a programmer in being able to admit that you might be wrong.
Well, mainly because Dave's code is crap. My code is the only beautiful code out there.
Yeah, who broke the concentrator?
It's beautiful,
week,
but it doesn't work.
But it's pretty. That's all that matters right now.
It's very pretty code that doesn't
do
anything.
We're sticking on one line at a time here.
Right. And I think, you know, ugly code kind of speaks for itself. I mean, ugly code is the spaghetti, it's the stunt coding, and God help us, sometimes it's even that functional code, that, you know, the functional programming that happens that people to use.
I like functional programming
functional
a lot.
Functional programming can be done well and it can be done elegantly, but too many people take it and run so far with it that it's like reading Perl. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Now, you had to say the P word, but there we go. There's the definition of ugly code. It's very pragmatic.
Yes, it is. And it was very good for its time. Oh, here come the emails. Well, bring it.
Also, I would definitely say
Ruby is ugly code.
Well, no, I don't necessarily think so.
See, that depends, though.
I know. I'm teasing.
A lot of Python code you get into, and you feel sick to your stomach when you read it.
Yes.
You see things that are just wrong, things that are, you know, the naming conventions that are just disgusting, and you know that design is so poor, and you don't want to get into it and code it, but you have to for whatever reason.
Well, I'm going
to
call out Report Lab because it's caused me the most pain recently. Mm-hmm. Now, I get that it's old code, but it still hurts a lot, and it kind of, in my mind, at least recently, defines what is like ugly code.
Well, see, you know, but that's kind of tricky, though, isn't it? Because okay, it is ugly now. It may not have been ugly when you got started.
That's very true. But now, when you're making a comparison, like recently, I compared it to the PDF library in the Zend framework for PHP,
mm-hmm.
and I called PHP beautiful. That's kind of
right,
the
you
point
have to
now
leave.
We've got problems.
You just have to go now.
Hand in your Python card. I'm sorry.
Hey, sometimes I need my PHP fix. Yeah. It's a bad habit, I know.
Yeah, well, we can talk about PHP another time. So, ready to move on to the next one? Or does anyone have any further thoughts on beautiful versus ugly code?
Well, one of the things that I think is really important that makes code beautiful is attention to every single detail. You know, a lot of people will breeze through something and, sure, you followed PEP 8, but your design sucks. Or, oh, your design is great, but your conventions suck. I think every single character that you type, you really kind of have to think about and really craft. Because if you don't pay attention to detail, I don't think you can write beautiful code.
Okay, and to play devil's advocate here, that's really great, but some people work on a deadline.
I don't think that you necessarily have to sacrifice your deadline for beautiful code, though.
No?
I think it's more of a... Writing beautiful code is more of something that you learn as you write more and more code. And the way you can kind of learn to write beautiful code is to write more code.
So
code caught us.
One point to that, though, with legacy code, mm-hmm. is that I also think consistency is beautiful. So if I get into something that looks a certain way, even though it's not the way I would consider beautiful, I would stick to that way. Stick to that design, stick to those naming conventions, just so the entire thing is consistent.
Well, and some of the biggest train wrecks in otherwise beautiful code are those new guys that go in and say, hey, you know, this would be great, except I'm going to name all my variables with underscores instead of camel case, which is what this code uses. It's a train wreck.
Do you know any of those guys, Mike?
No.
I don't think we're going to call out anybody on that.
No, I've
seen that code. It's a train wreck.
But you get into a tricky spot there, especially when dealing with legacy code. Do you work with the existing convention, even though it doesn't match PEP?
Absolutely.
Or do you get into the trap of trying to bring everything up to spec? And, you know, do you always have the choice to make it beautiful?
Well, when you've really got two situations there. You can either follow the convention and stick with what you may consider to be ugly, or you can rewrite the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Now, at work, we've got a 700,000 line code base.
Yeah, we won't be, yeah.
Doing that is just, it's not practical. So I think sticking with the current convention, even though you personally may disagree with it, is really important.
Well, I don't want to go through and do a diff and see like 10,000 lines of change because you decided to do a mass rename across the entire code base.
Yeah, I think that becomes kind of an issue.
Yeah, that code review would be kind of nasty. I think it's one of those things that I'm being afforded a certain luxury right now at work where I'm going back and taking something that I wrote last year, refactoring it, making it better, expanding it somewhat, building it with tests, you know, kind of doing it right. Whereas before I did it and it worked and it got us through peak. But I'm able to make it better right now. And I think that's a useful exercise in learning, you know, what your own mistakes are and how you can make it better. You know, and we talk to our peers, we use code review, that kind of thing. But I think beauty is a lot like, it's a journey. You know, it's something that's ever evolving and ever, you know, ever growing. And it's kind of like, you know, keeping a boxwood hedge in your backyard, right? A code base is kind of like that, where it will begin to grow, and if you don't carefully trim and if you don't carefully prune, that thing's going to be out of control, and you'll never get it under control again.
Well, I think it's like anything else. The more you practice it and the more you kind of work on writing code and trying to build beautiful code, the more beautiful the code you're going to turn out
is. You're talking about beautiful as a habit, where the more you write in a certain fashion, the more it becomes habit to do so, the less you actually have to think about doing it because it just begins to happen after a time.
Right. I would even say that, consider paintings. I'm sure Michelangelo's very first painting was total crap. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that now we consider his later works to be some of the best works of art ever created by man.
Right.
I think code's a lot the same way, where you really have to just keep doing it and keep perfecting your craft to get to that point where you're writing beautiful code.
And actually, Michelangelo is a really good example, because Michelangelo painted the Sistine Chapel with all the different scenes. And then another pope brought him back 25 years later to paint the last Judgment. And the Last Judgment is in a very different style. Both are beautiful. Both are amazing. But two very different styles of work.
And I actually think you bring up a really great point in that what's beautiful to you may not be beautiful to somebody else.
It's true. Well, that's the aesthetic, isn't it?
Well, you've got to resist the temptation to enforce your view of beauty onto everybody else.
See, that's a really interesting point, because when you were saying that, I was thinking that I haven't seen code that was written more than a couple months ago that I would consider beautiful. You look at code you wrote 10 years ago, and it's completely crap. Everybody would agree it's completely crap.
No, I would disagree, though. There are things that I've written in the past, not many. Actually, I can only think of one off the top of my head that I still go back to and say, wow, that was actually really kind of a beautiful piece of code.
Well, you know, a good example, I was going through an old code base of, God help me, ASP 3.0 code, all right? And I was looking at this one particularly complex thing that we did, and it was great. It worked well. It flowed. It did the right thing. Now, the fact that it was an ASP causes me some pain. But the structure, and admittedly, this is one function in a lot of code, but I think you do occasionally find those gems. And the sad thing about those gems is that the most that you can do is probably frame it and put it on your wall, because you're not going to find the case to use it again necessarily. So.
But you can also learn from it. I mean, it's something that you can look back on and really contemplate and think, you know, what makes it beautiful and how can I apply that to my code now?
The fact that you're talking about one function way back in your career and you're talking about one small part of one system way back in your career kind of validates the point that usually...
Sturgeon's Law, 90% of everything is crap, but the other 10% is to die for.
There's one thing you find that you haven't figured out a better way yet. And in 5 years?
I'm not saying that you'll never find a better way. But, you know, things can have their own beauty.
I agree.
All right.
So the other last closing thought for the beautiful code is that really, if you think about a lot of the other entries on the Zen of Python, it kind of rolls back up into the beauty of the code. Simplicity and readability and all that kind of stuff.
Design. Right.
Design.
It's true. Do you think the whole white space thing fits into this at all?
White space is beautiful. And anyone that says that it's not is crazy. Now, I'm not saying that languages like C that use braces and semicolons, they can benefit from white space. I mean, the fact that white space is significant in Python is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. I think white space is critically important to someone understanding your program, or at least being able to easily read it.
Yeah, it's readability and maintainability. I mean, I have, you know, you wouldn't want to try to maintain a JavaScript file that's been, what's the term, crunched? Though, you know, when they take it and crunch it down and they,
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't want to try to maintain that. It's the same code.
Although, as an interesting aside, we actually tried to, a buddy of mine and I tried to understand Gmail when it first came out.
Oh, God.
And trying to read minified code.
That's the minified.
Not so awesome.
No. God, no.
Imagine if you had to maintain that forever, and then you can kind of really appreciate beautiful code and white space.
Fair point. All right. Next item. Explicit is better than implicit.
Oh, you could go a lot of different places with
this.
This
is one of my favorites, yeah.
Well, it kind of comes back to, I think a theme in Python is the meta model. Mm-hmm. You know, the meta model in Python is really beautiful, but it encourages so many people to do so many horrible things that you can do a lot of implicit magic, but is it the right thing to do?
Well, that's fair. I think that's fair. That was like reflection in .NET. It was a really neat idea, but God, if you were using it, you better have a damn fine reason for doing it, because no one's going to understand what's going on. But I think this even goes to something very simple. I mean, to people who enjoy writing a single line of code that does string.join.split.replace. You know, and instead of doing all of those many functions back to back, taking it apart for readability and the ability to follow the code. Oh, here I'm splitting, here I'm replacing, here I'm...
Well, and I think there's something to that, in the sense that creating a variable that's just named something sane, just so you can feed it one time into the next function, and so it flows nicely, I think is really important.
I would agree.
So, I mean, when I also think of implicit code, I think of things that either do magic under the hood, have weird side effects back and forth that are really hard to understand. And then the new user coming in that tries to use that API doesn't understand that, okay, well, it's going to tack on a bunch of stuff to your object, or it's going to do this thing in the background. And, you know, when they try to replace certain parts of the code, they don't understand what's going on all the way.
So is DI too implicit?
No, I think DI is the exact opposite because you know exactly what the interface is that you're getting in. I think it's usually the opposite. Instead of, you know, in DI, you're passing an object into another object, right? So you're explicitly saying you accept this thing. A lot of people in Python land use weird factory magic to just figure out what the right instance is and do like a get whatever and pass something back. And that's really hard to replicate.
But I think it's something that you've even ranted on about Spring in the past is you really can't see in your code like what's wired up. Juice has the same kind of problem where you have to go look at a different file to understand how your code works together. It all feels very implicit.
You always have to do that anyways, though, right? Because if you're a class and you accept something into a method, you don't know who's passing in what. You have to go somewhere else to find it. With DI, even with Spring, even though I don't like XML, you have one or two places you go to look to find what that thing is, mm-hmm. right? So it's a little bit easier to kind of find those things. But I think that's very explicit because you're saying, give me this thing, and that's what I want, this interface.
I think that's fair. All right.
Next. Well, actually, before we jump on to the next one,
please,
though, I actually think this is one of the problems Ruby's having right now. Is the whole monkey patching, and I would consider monkey patching to be kind of part of the whole implicit problem.
Let's do a couple of things here.
Want to skip past that?
No, because we have some beginners listening to this show. DI means dependency injection, and I'd recommend going and looking that up. We'll have a show about that, but it's what's the best way to describe dependency injection to a beginner?
It's essentially the idea that you're passing all the dependencies into an object. Instead of going out and grabbing stuff all over the place, I need a logger, I need this, I need that, I need a database connection, you get them passed into you so you don't have to actually create them yourself.
Right, kind of a real stateless object.
Yeah, something outside of you makes that stuff for you.
All right, so, can't remember what you just said.
Monkey patching.
Monkey patching.
Or duck punching.
Explain monkey patching.
Well, so monkey patching is the behavior of, in some piece of code, manipulating globals in another piece of code and most often another part of the system. Stuff that's going to hang around for a long time, even replacing methods on objects.
So would this be doing something like overriding and renaming URL lib2 to do something completely different?
It would actually be something like replacing URL open with your own implementation.
All right, okay.
At runtime. So in a way that you're going to replace that thing, but nobody's really going to know that it's replaced. Mm-hmm. So they may expect some behavior you didn't emulate in the code that you just stuck in there.
That sounds horrible. Why would you do such a thing?
Well, it seems to be kind of a problem where people want to extend the behavior of a built-in or a class or something provided by another part of the system, but really don't consider that, especially in a language like Python, where if you monkey patch URL lib, everybody is going to see your monkey patched version. Mm-hmm. It modifies ways in the code in ways that are kind of difficult to understand it and causes really subtle bugs. Mm-hmm. But I think that's part of the problem too with in Ruby you can monkey patch the built-ins. Like you can monkey patch object and the string and all of these core built-ins. I think that kind of implicit behavior that you see there is really some of the problems that language is facing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to be fair, it's also part of the strength and the flexibility of that particular language too.
Very true.
You know, the fact that you can, you know, use it to create whole other almost languages makes it a very powerful thing.
It's a really nice weapon, and you're almost always pointing at your own foot. Exactly. That's the problem.
It's actually, I would go so far as to say, strapped to your own leg. Wow. There's no way you can pull that trigger safely.
That's not Ruby. The idea of monkey patching I'm talking about.
Right. Well, it's worth clarifying.
Don't try this at home, kids. We're trained professionals. I mean,
don't patch anybody's monkey and don't punch any ducks.
That's all right.
Well, actually, there's a really great story about that. In my younger days of Python, I needed some special behavior out of the CGI library.
Like 15?
Oh, come on, Chris. That was kind of a low blow. well, it was a couple of years ago, but I needed some specific behavior out of the URL, out of the CGI library.
I remember this very well.
And so I monkey patched the CGI library.
Holy crap.
It was really great too, because all of our applications run inside the same app server. So when I monkey patch CGI, I monkey patch CGI for everything.
And then he came coming over to me saying, your app server sucks. It's doing all this bad stuff.
I did indeed say that. Yeah, it was not one of my more brilliant moments.
After about a half hour, I figured out that, oh, it's calling some other URL encode, or I can't remember what you actually...
It was URL encode, yeah. Because the billing system, all of their XML now had pluses instead of spaces.
That was fantastic.
That's great.
But it was a great example of why you should never monkey patch anything.
Friends, don't let friends monkey patch the enterprise system. All right, next item. Simple is better than complex.
I mean, this one should be pretty obvious.
Yeah. I don't know if you could... This is pretty simple.
Well, it is pretty simple.
Is it really, though? I mean, consider for a minute that perhaps some of the most brilliant programmers, the way that they can express something extremely complex in a very simple fashion is pure genius. Something that none of us would really consider. Wouldn't consider how to do that.
The fact that simple is better than complex is, I mean, that's a no-brainer.
True.
How you make something simple, I think, is...
Well, that's an art in and of itself.
Yeah, you can't put to words. I mean, take volumes to actually explain how to do that, if you could even do that at all.
But I think it's kind of implied that not only is simple better than complex, you building simple code is better than you building complicated code.
Sure.
Okay, fine. Maybe we're digging too deep into this.
Actually, you know what? This is a quote that I found. Command Line sent it over. Fools ignore complexity. Pragmatists suffer it. Some can avoid it. Geniuses remove it.
That's a really good quote.
That's an excellent quote.
Is that from him or is that someone?
No. It was. It's from. I can't remember who it's actually from. I'll see if I can put it in the show notes.
That's great.
It was linked. It was 115 epigrams about programming that is being kept up at a university. I'll see if I can find them and we'll post them.
I mean, for me, the simplicity is just about describing your intent in a very easy way so that anybody else can come along after you and understand what was going on. And it eliminates a lot of the debugging problems that most people have. And they're looking at really crappy code, trying to figure out what's going on. If it's straightforward and simple, you can kind of understand and follow the flow.
Now, this dovetails into complex is better than complicated. Now, explain to me that difference.
Of complex being better than complicated?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would opt for simplicity always. But, I mean, I think what he was trying to get at is the fact that some things are going to get complicated in the algorithms you're going to use. Mm-hmm. Right? If you're building Google and you're trying to make searching algorithms, it's going to be pretty complicated. Mm-hmm. Financial applications, you know, there's things that are complicated. Right. But... I think the idea is that you make it as simple as possible and no simpler. I mean, that's been said like a million times in different contexts.
Right.
But some things are just going to be more complex than other things.
Right. Well, but even then you use complex and complicated interchangeably.
Well, I think, that's a good point. So in my mind, some people add in complexity all the time, more and more complexity. They think that they're going to have to handle different situations they don't have yet. And they build very complicated code, even though they don't need it. Very over designed. So the idea to me is just make everything as simple as possible. And this is just like another level of that. Okay. Some things are going to be a little bit harder than simple, and some things are going to be a little bit harder than that. And
so, well, consider even like if you step back a little bit into the days of assembly, there's more than one way to divide a number.
Sure.
There's complicated ways using bit shifts, and although they're faster, they're more complicated. There's the very simple way of just dividing the number.
Right. Well, you know, when I think of this, I think of a complex system is built of a number of simple parts. A complicated system is built of a number of complex parts.
See, that I don't know. I think that kind of gets back into the difference between the two.
Yeah. I mean, I guess complicated seems to imply some form of near obfuscation. You know, almost something that makes it untenable, unsustainable. A complex system is not necessarily unmaintainable.
So difficulty without justification, maybe, would
perhaps,
be a good example.
Or
a good definition.
I think the words are arbitrary. I think the last two... entries that we're going over, if you just use numbers, zero being really simple, 10 being the most complicated thing imaginable, you want to make it towards zero.
Right.
And some things just aren't going to be zero. They're going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the idea is that you drive out the complexity into simpler, smaller functional components.
Okay.
And it's not really the words that matter. It's the fact that you're trying to drive out that complexity as much as possible.
I would say that the words do matter, though, because there's a certain poetry even to this Zen of Python thing. And I have not seen a language that's had as close to a mission statement as this thing is. If, just to go back, Command Line, Thomas Gideon, who runs the Command Line podcast at thecommandline.net, and I were discussing this one night, and it led into him writing an essay about Java becoming the gray lady, who, you know, and how the Java community, while it was early on, it was very fired up, they still never had something quite like this to keep development focused. And admittedly, this probably started off as a joke, but some of the best aphorisms start as the joke. And when you divine truth from it, that becomes something interesting.
That's true, but you also have to consider that a lot of Python programmers, especially new programmers, probably have never read the Zen of Python.
This is probably also true.
But I think those are the people that are probably more apt to build these complicated solutions than the people who have been coding Python for a while.
I just what?
Sorry, I just took a look at the implementation of this, and that's actually kind of funny.
Oh, God. Okay.
Most complicated Rot 13 you've ever seen, huh?
Oh, that's God. Great.
All right. Okay.
Which is actually kind of contrary to this entire point that we were talking about.
I'll have to take a look at this. Obviously, it's being funny. All right. Flat is better than nested.
Now, this is an interesting one because I think out of everything in the Zen, this is one that can actually be measured, quantitatively measured.
That's true.
Through cyclomatic complexity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting in that respect. But it's also interesting when you look at how often we violate this. Take a look even at parts of the standard library. And of course, I prepared these notes like 5 minutes before we started recording, so I didn't get an example.
Yes.
But I'm going to pull this one right out of the air, but the tokenizer library,
mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure is an extremely nested piece of code. And it's difficult to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can also say if you look at, I think, CGITB from the standard library, where it may not be nested in terms of blocks, or it may be, I don't know, but it's nested in the things that it has, or the things that it does. So some of it actually generates the traceback, some of it generates HTML, it does all kinds of things in the same little area. And that's just another level of nested. So it's nested responsibilities instead of just nested blocks. And then the other interesting thing about the nestedness is that from what I've seen in a lot of the open source projects I've been looking through is that they don't take advantage of the polymorphic behavior of objects. They do a lot of branching on, you know, with if statements to try to figure out which things they need to call based on which objects they're in. And, you know, in reality, that's not the right way to design code.
Well, and I think a lot of the times that you see some of these really deeply nested chain conditional kind of things, there's a huge violation of the single responsibility principle. A lot of time, these are the same kind of functions where you see people passing in 16 booleans, where it's just like there's just so much going on in that code.
That's dependency injection. No, I'm kidding.
you were just looking how to use DI here.
Yeah, that's it. I'm just looking to use DI, so I'm going to pass. I'm actually going to redefine. I'm going to monkey patch the boolean, and I'm going to because I want a maybe. So
instead of designing right, we'll just add another boolean so that we can do another switch somewhere to figure out what else we should do in a different way. And then all of a sudden, you got to do that in 5 different places, and then next time it's 8 places, and it's just insane.
Well, and I think this kind of plays a little bit to the fact that ifs are evil. If you're doing a ton of ifs in your program, you're probably doing it wrong.
Sparse is better than dense.
Well, okay, so my biggest problem with... I don't have a problem with this one, but my biggest problem with a lot of code that I read is people don't get white space. White space is not your enemy. Blank lines are not your enemy. Use white space.
How do you use white space?
I think it depends a little bit on context. I mean, for
keep
sure
in mind that we've seen your code and we will call you out on this.
Well, for sure the PEP8 standards are great, but I don't think they go far enough. When your logical chunks of your code should be separated by white space. One of my favorite conventions is when you're going into a for loop to build out an object, don't put white space there, but put white space before and after those lines. So try and keep your code so that when you read through it in chunks, you can actually understand what's going on.
So you're basically saying a suite of code is surrounded by white space.
A suite of code,
you're taking parts of it out so that it's logical chunks, and
even within a single function.
And by white space, we're talking about one line.
We're talking about single lines of white space. Although you can argue this for the spaces around commas and spaces around operator kind of thing, but that's less the point.
But there are also certain readability things. Like, nothing drives me crazy more crazy than someone who in their function doesn't have any spaces between the comma and the next variable. Now, part of this is I was an English major. And I learned comma space. But to me, it's more readable. It's just easier to get around.
I mean, for whatever reason, it drives me batshit. I don't understand why, but we do it a lot at work, or other people do it at work, and it drives me crazy.
What do you mean, not putting spaces?
Not putting spaces. And then everything kind of runs together in one big line of
stuff. And not putting new lines, too. I mean, I think blank lines really help a lot, especially when you're not familiar with the code and you're just going and reading it for the first time. Having extremely dense code is just very difficult to follow.
No, I think you're right. But I also think that, and this comes down to, you know, making sure your functions are small enough and broken down enough. You know, if you've got several blocks of code in your function, you may want to look at refactoring that.
Well, I actually think Joe Fiorini called that out in a tweet he made a while ago, that white space is actually a design flaw in your program, or probably means that you're violating some design principles.
Now, that's an interesting point of view. I'd like to hear him justify that. Hey, Joe, you want to be on the show? Joe's not listening.
You know,
Joe
after all we've...
Joe programs Ruby.
He does. So after all the insulting to Ruby, I don't think he's going to come anywhere near us.
We'll just catch him in code match. All right.
So now that we've kind of looked past some of the on the surface sparse is better than dense.
Yes.
I think we can extend it even though to the code you write, in the sense that there's a lot of 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 line Python programs out there. And the fact that people don't split these up into different files, different packages, take advantage of these tools that Python gives you with import, I think that's another case of where we're just writing a lot of dense code, even if there's more white space in that file than you can imagine.
Well, you know, this is one of those things that I had a guy years ago who had this enormous... It was an enormous script, all broken up into classes and everything, but it was like 5,000 lines in one text file. And it took us forever to try to convince him that, you know, another file is cheap and you can, you know, do the equivalent of importing. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing, but he was an older style programmer who was thinking of disk space.
Well, we have grep for people.
So that's just an inode
I know, but that's what I mean, is that he was looking at it from everything's in one place, everything's easier to find.
Crazy talk.
Right, I know. But at the same time, a lot of there are people out there that have a problem with, you know, a class and a module that has maybe 2 or 3 functions in it. It feels like a waste to break those out. And I've heard people say this. Now, it's an aesthetic choice for the most part, but I would argue that it makes the organization of things much easier.
Well, and I'm not going to call it right, because I think it's far from right, but I think there's at least something to be considered in the fact that Java forces you to have a single class per file. If you code Java for a while, which I've had the great fortune to do recently, you kind of start to think, oh wait, does all this Python code really belong in this file, or should I be pulling it out?
No, and I think that's a fair point. Just because you can do some things with Python doesn't mean you should.
Now again, back to the whole one class per file, we shouldn't do that, because for Pete's sake, we are not Java. But we should at least take that as a lesson that maybe we should break up our code a little bit.
I think this goes to a bigger discussion, probably one that we can have on another show, about the virtue of working in other languages to bring back lessons to what you do, you know, the majority of your time, kind of the 80-20 thing.
So number 19 is namespaces are good. You should use them. This kind of ties into that idea, breaking code up. They're all like entangled, all these items of Zen.
I think it does, but I think there's some different points that kind of go along with that.
No, there's more to it than just that. But I mean, all these things are kind of tied together. So another thing that we didn't really talk about, we talked a lot about dense code, but what about the dense design? What about the single responsibility and having more than one thing in the same entity? And, you know, having the wrong design and putting everything in one big class.
Mm-hmm. Inheritance sucks.
Dense code.
Yes, that's not a fair point. You know, the sparseness of your classes, the way things are laid out. I mean,
there's a lot to design. You know, if you think about like loose coupling, right? Instead of having a bunch of things that highly depend on each other and you can't break them apart, you separate them. You put them in different parts of the code base and different packages so they don't depend directly on each other. And you start getting better into your design.
Well, and if you've never done it, I think it's a worthwhile exercise. Write a entire program where every single class only inherits from object. Force yourself to do that. And the designs you're going to come up with out of that are going to be drastically different than what you could have maybe easily solved with inheritance. But I also think they'll be easier to read, easier to understand, and have a lot less violations of things like single responsibility, open, close.
Oh, I definitely agree to that.
Okay, the next one is almost like a toss-out here.
Kind of like almost like a joke.
Almost. Readability counts. Now, I can take a couple of ways to say this, or to read how this is, but to me, it's almost a slap in the face to the programming community at large that it even needs to be said that readability counts. It's almost, it's a very big smartass comment to say, oh yeah, by the way.
Well, and it really shouldn't have to be said, mm-hmm. but it's along the lines of the whole beautiful is better than ugly.
Yes.
I mean, what is readability? Something mm-hmm. that's extremely readable to Dave may be totally unreadable, a hodgepodge of words to me.
See, I don't know. I'm yes and no. I mean, I'm not buying some of that.
I had a great thought for that, but I'm not going to say it out loud.
Only because of working with good Python programmers, none of whom are in this room. No, I'm kidding. Because of working with good Python programmers, you find certain patterns in good Python code. You know, and you'll find a lot of, ANSI patterns as well. No one's perfect. But you can begin to look at, you can look at your code, and if you can look at your code and say, this is not good because, and chances are it's because you have a reference to something else that you've seen that is good. And that good probably came from someone else. You know, everybody learns from someone else. And so I think there is a baseline, this is how Python code should be written. This is how, and it's probably called PEP 8, but point is that I think there is a baseline for what good code looks like, at least on its most basic text editor, I'm reading through a file sort of way. I'm not talking about design there. Design's a little bit more complex.
Well, this is just readability, so. Right.
I know, exactly.
But now here's one, though, that I think is very much a part of readability that so many people gloss over is comments. I think comments are
What do you need comments? You've got the code.
Comments are the worst possible thing a language can have. I would go so far as to say comments are a design flaw in a language, and you using them indicates that you have a huge design problem your code.
I don't know if I buy that, but I'm from another generation.
So I buy it to some extent. So like doc comments and classes and functions and methods and all that stuff. Good to have, especially in public APIs.
Yeah.
API documentation is kind of critical.
But you need
I'm
to
not
have
that
part of it.
Yeah.
But like, there's all kinds of code that says X equals whatever, and then in a hash comment they explain what X is.
Right.
Why not just name it properly and pass
it through? Right. And I think that's where it's fair, because the blanket statement that comments are bad is a little bit inflammatory and a little bit misleading, because what we're really saying is, and any comment where you actually have to explain what's happening in the function. Maybe that's not so good.
Well, and sometimes it's necessary, right? If you have an algorithm that you want to call out and just say, these next five lines are based off of, mm-hmm. This website or this thing or whatever, right. That's useful a lot of times.
It's almost annotation. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I, like every programmer, I will steal a good idea when I find one.
Absolutely.
I put a note in the code saying this idea came from over here and here's why I used it. As much for myself as it is for the next guy coming down.
But what I hate is when you get a function and every three lines have a comment saying what they're going to do next.
Well, yeah.
I'm going to be looping through this stuff. And, mm-hmm. I can see the for loop in the next line.
Worse than that, though, is that comments never get maintained. Code gets maintained all the time, but comments don't.
Depends. I mean, That's not an entirely fair statement. Depends on the comment and the developer. And
it depends on what they're doing, sure. But how many times have you read a piece of code that where the comment is totally irrelevant and actually describes behavior that doesn't even exist in the function?
No, I have seen that for sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, bad documentation is worse than no documentation at all.
Well, and there is a place for these kind of things. If you feel that you need documentation for your system, API documentation, that's why we have things like Sphinx. But just putting that in comments in your code is not a good idea. And actually that's kind of another point is that doc comments are horrible. I've seen 100-line comments that are just exist for doc comment parsers to pick up. People writing HTML in comments just to satisfy the doc comment parser. It's happened more in Java than Python, but it's still a horrible thing.
I mean, I like to have doc comments that are like a line or two long. I don't like to have everything in it.
I would disagree because the thing is that there's a lot to be said for the readability of the generated documentation. And if you're generating this for a third party to use, there's a lot to be said for formatting. There's a lot to be said for... Now, I'm not saying you would do this everywhere. But I know that I myself have been in situations where I was writing a third party, you know, I was the third party writing this set of classes. And yeah, I did that so that when I generated the code, it generated a nice professional looking documentation.
The only time I
pass on.
The only time I ever do that is in the module level doc comments.
Okay.
I'll put like examples of how to use something. And in the actual method itself, I'll put a really short description.
Okay.
And then the code itself is much more readable and the documentation is separate. And a lot of times now I've been taking that out and putting it into a separate text file in the docs directory.
Right. Now,
to simplify all of it.
No, but to this point, I see what you're doing more often in Python than what we were just talking about.
True.
I used to see this a lot in C#.
Well, Java is
One that's Java, particularly but that's because, bad
you know,
about
Java
it.
And
Perl,
you know,
right? Isn't that the pod crap that they have spread out all over the place? They have a humongous thing inside of each Perl file?
Well, and while that documentation is all fine and good, and in many cases serves a really useful purpose, like generating man pages, it doesn't belong in your code. And I think that's part of what makes some code very unreadable is how much you just have to read past all these huge doc comments and man pages and all this crap in the source file.
So a great example of that frustrated me to no end was, I think, the Memcache API. Because there's like functions or methods in it that have like 40 lines of comment, but are like 3 lines of code.
Yep.
And it's like the most insane thing you could imagine.
It's like, you know, if you're going to write a book, put it in an open office file. Put it in a text file outside.
Restructured text is the only way.
You know, whichever way you choose to do it. But I would agree, if you're writing novels in your code, take the novel out of it.
and doc tests are the same thing. Take your doc tests and put them in a unit test file.
What you just said was very profound. Take the novel out of your code. It goes more into than just the actual documentation.
See, there's our 20th line to make it even.
There you go. I like that.
All right. Next item. Special cases aren't special enough to break the rules. Discuss.
We always think they are.
This is the fun part because this is where I break all the other rules. Uh-huh. Because while... I understand it completely. I can't always not break and do special cases. But if you want to go into, you know, the perfect program and how would I do it if I had unlimited time and unlimited funds and, you know, no one yelling at me, I would definitely try to fix the design that I'm, you know, basically monkey patching stuff into. Mm-hmm. And the usual case for a lot of this stuff is that, oh, I didn't anticipate this thing and I don't really have time to fix it. So sure. I'm going to add an if over here and just going to, you know, put in a little block of code that's going to hack stuff together.
Well, right. You know, the perfect code would be all nice and feng shui and the energy would flow through it in little compartments.
And it'd be beautiful.
It'd be beautiful and awesome and it would never survive contact.
Every time you open it, it'd be,
Exactly. There'd be little Jesus beams and all that. I mean, it'd be awesome.
Jesus beams.
There's something to be said for pragmatism, too, though.
There is.
I mean, we all have to get a job done in a certain amount of time.
I think that's a fair... That's always the balance, isn't it? I mean, so many of the things that we do offend our delicate sensibilities, but the reality of it is that sometimes it's just about grinding it out.
Yeah,
I have made them sad.
Well, a buddy of mine has a great saying that I love is, you know, quit being such a sensitive fucking flower.
Yep.
And now, of course, he's a Perl programmer and a sysadmin, but it's a really great point. I mean, you know, just suck it up and deal with it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to do that. And some rules need to be broken.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah, I mean, my preference now is to, and it's really hard when you're dealing with legacy code, but try to design things in a way, like Mike was talking earlier, where things are less of this inheritance hierarchy and more of these collaborating objects, so that it's easy to fix those things and easy to just pass something different in when I need something different.
Yeah, no.
It's really difficult when you're dealing with a big legacy code base to do all those things.
Especially if you're switching paradigms midstream like you are. I mean, let's face it, a lot of this was built very OO, very inheritance-driven, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and what you were talking earlier about doing the code that you, or redoing the code you did last year.
Yeah.
Last summer, I was redoing the code I did 8 years ago.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's
amazing. It's an experience.
It's amazing the things that you've learned, right? I mean,
absolutely.
I was redoing code Dave did 8 years ago today, too, and yeah, it's not pretty.
Yeah.
None of that code was actually mine, the stuff you were just talking about earlier.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure. Pass the buck now.
It's funny. It's got your name in the comments.
I came in on a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and then there's one other thing that I think is worth mentioning with the special cases is it's back to the meta model. The Python meta model encourages people to do a lot of really horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things we can do to kind of maybe help frame our mindset with respect to special cases is code some Java, code some C#. Seriously, get out of the Python box for a little bit into a language that's a lot more restrictive.
Yeah.
And then come back and take a look at Python. When you're in a language that doesn't have an easily accessible meta model, you're going to totally think about things differently, and you're going to come back to Python and think twice before you implement that meta class or that get attribute.
I don't know if I agree with that, because I know a lot of people that have been coming to Python from C# and Java, and they think, oh, crap, I can do that? And they do. And their day jobs are Java, C#.
Yeah.
And when they go to Python, they say, I can do all this stuff, so I'm going to do it. And they don't, they're not, since they're not really into it and they're not seeing years of crap pile up on top of each other, they'll continue to do it.
That's how I came to this. I came to this from C#, and I remember the first piece of Python that I ever wound up writing was just doing something to fetch an RSS feed. The fact that I could do it in 2 lines instead of 7 just blew my mind. I was so happy. But it's, I think what's kind of funny about that is I've had some Java and C# programmers that I've spoken to talk about, they've listened to our first podcast and some of the other podcasts and things like that. And, you know, you Python guys, you're a bunch of Nazis. you're all, it's all this way or it's the highway. It's all that. And I would come back on that and say, I think it's because we tend to be more strict because the language isn't. And it doesn't enforce a discipline.
It treats you like a consenting adult. And in that respect, I think now you have all of the responsibilities of a consenting adult.
That's exactly it. Is that, you know, you can only do certain things in these highly structured language because the parser will save you. The compiler will stop you.
Well, they put up the baby gates.
Yeah, exactly. There's no baby gates here.
But that's a great case for us being more strict, too.
Exactly. I mean, a responsible adult does not spend all his money drinking every night. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Wait, what?
I know. You brought the beer this time, so.
Can you pass the scotch?
Yeah, I wish we had the scotch. Someone didn't bring the scotch.
I was expecting somebody to buy it for us. Oh. I mean, one of our adoring fans.
Would that be Steve Holden?
It very well could be. It
could be. Hi, Steve. All right. Next item is actually a follow-up, which is, although practicality beats purity, and I think that goes back to your first comments on the last item,
absolutely.
You know, I'd love to believe that I'd never have a special case that would break the rules, but you always do.
I always have a special case.
Yeah,
but I think it speaks a little bit to you got to get the job done. But again, don't try and make it as beautiful as you can inside kind of that box of practicality.
As beautiful as you can, but no more beautiful.
Yes.
Don't overthink it.
Yeah, you can't put lipstick on a pig. Anyway.
You can, but they're hard to hold down.
Well, and you know what? I think that brings us to the end of our run for this particular episode. Thank you so much for joining us. We're just a few guys just sitting around having a couple of brews, talking coding with you. We're glad you could make it. We'd love it if you leave us some comments up on the blog or drop us a line at feedback@fromPythonImportPodcast.com.
Especially on this topic, because it's very subjective to every person what these things actually mean. I'd love to hear other people's opinions on what they actually mean.
If you have the means to record audio and email it to us, we will play it. We will work it into the show. We would love to have people give us lots of comments, lots of feedback, lots of your own thoughts, because we're just a bunch of, you know, half in the bottle jerk offs over here. And we are by no means the prophets of Python.
This is Chris Miller speaking.
Yeah, no. my point is that, you know, opinions, you know what opinions are like. So
everybody has one.
Yeah, they all stink.
And mine's correct.
Yeah. Oof. All right. On that note, we are signing off. We will be back in a couple of weeks with part two of The Zen of Python. Ciao, baby. This job fulfilling in creative way. Such a load of crap. Code Monkey thinks someday he... This podcast has been released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives Works 3.0 Unported License. The theme song for this podcast is Code Monkey by Jonathan Colton. Learn more about him at jonathancolton.com. To learn more about us or to catch up on past shows, please visit us at FromPythonImportPodcast.com. Monkey like you.